what sticks with me most is the friends that I've made over the years, and that I met through just these online conversations, like-minded people, and like-minded meaning, you know, people who are just like to talk about things and, you know, really like politics and policy and ideas.
This is the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Welcome, everybody, to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast, and we're very excited to be back up and running on our History of the Blogosphere series, and we have a great guest today, an old friend of the blog and acquaintance of both of us, the incomparable Laura McKenna, who has had the blog Apartment 11D, and then I think it went back to 11D, and now it's Apartment 11D, so it's still and has posts from March 2024. So we have with us a legitimate OG blogger who's still in the game, one of the precious few, and hasn't even moved to Substack. Still has the old blog. So we're really getting somebody who's in the ethos now. And Laura is a former academic. So as I'm sure we'll talk about at some point, got out while the getting was good, and then is now involved in local activism around education and consultancy, in addition to her writing, and still in New Jersey, right?
Yes.
So good. So we have finally a Jersey representative on the show. So Laura, thank you so much for coming on. This is really cool.
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of Sopranos over the last couple of weeks, and so I feel like
as am I. 25th anniversary, so it's like the perfect preparation.
Okay. Yeah,
a little gabagool. Let's go.
Yeah, Bruce.
Little got pie.
Jersey girl. That's me. Big hair. Big hair. Don't care.
The highways are jammed with Broken Heroes and a Last Chance Power Drives. And
speaking my songs. Yeah. Well, thanks for, inviting me on. We're all political scientists, or I'm a former political scientist. And, we've all been online writing for a super long time. And looking forward to, chatting with you guys about the old days.
Absolutely. So why don't we start off by talking about the old days? And, the question I generally like to open this with is, when did you start blogging and why did you start blogging?
I actually looked this up today. I started blogging July 11th, 2003. And unlike some of the other bloggers you've interviewed, I actually started off more as a personal blogger rather than a political blogger, even though I have a political science background. At the time I started, I had a one-year-old and a three-and-a-half-year-old, and I was teaching one class at Columbia on Wednesday evenings, and my husband and I had both sort of recovering from academia. I was still in it, but he had a PhD in European history, and there was just no jobs. So he got a temp job at Morgan Stanley and started off as a secretary at Morgan Stanley. And it gradually, he was not a trader, but he was working more doing the contracts and organizing that for an investment bank. And that was paying our rent. And I was not going to make enough money to pay for daycare. So I stayed, I didn't go on the job of job hunt. I taught that one class at Columbia, which paid $3,000. It was a grad school class. And I did all the prep work and grading over the weekends when he was back. But mostly I was bored out of my mind. I was watching Thomas the Tank Engine videos and changing diapers. And I was missing the intellectual stimulation of being in a classroom and being, I've been working in grad school, not only, doing the classes, but I was doing policy analysis for education policy for paper, research for the Ford Foundation. Like I was used to working and being around smart people. And suddenly it was, you know, PBS and Kalu. And I started off just writing personal stuff. My husband was the first one to read blogs. He was reading Andrew Sullivan and Lilacs, and he showed me it. And the next day I started a blog on Blogger. I'm kind of the person who just jumps in without a plan and just did it. And then I quickly discovered the academic blogosphere first. Brook and Timber, Tim Burke, and The Invisible Adjunct.
Yes.
And I really got into, you know, the critiques of, you know, academia and, you know, how poorly paid adjuncts were and how, you know, yet they were doing, you know, the majority of the teaching at universities. And then I was getting involved in, you know, debates about education policy at Crooked Timber. And, you know, I went from, like, my first blog posts were like about like my kids. And very quickly I went from that to talking more about politics and academia. So
I'm going to come back to the academic thing in a second, but I'm also interested in that. You know, there were also a lot, you know, there's also the kind of genre of academics who kind of did personal blogs, then moved into it. I mean, obviously Ted Rosell, who we talked to earlier, is that, you know, a rather less bourgeois personal blog than yours, but yeah. Same thing, you know, somebody that we knew from grad school at UW. Because part of our union organization drive, but you know, before we knew who she was, you know, obviously wrote this personal blog, and is also actually somebody who's really interested in educational policy. And I remember her telling me too that you know, after she kind of left her tenure track position and they went back to California, that it was very hard for her to get back in academia because, you know, the cost of teaching adjunct would be far greater than not working at all, you know, considering the needs for like a car and daycare and so on, at least before a kid was in college. And so it is interesting the extent to which, you know, that there's kind of the, you know, the sort of hardcore academic blogosphere. And then there's the academics who kind of write personal blogs, but then would also kind of get back into politics. And so it's sort of interesting, those two streams. And again, it kind of shows sort of how, you know, the kind of porous boundaries and kind of how, and again, and I like your thing of just making it up as you go along. It took us forever to actually start a blog. You know, we were parts of blog communities, and it took us like all leaving grad school for Rob to suggest, you know, let's do this. So we kind of have a community together as we get scattered to the four winds. So it's cool that you just took the plunge immediately. It's like, well, I'm not wasting time writing in other people's comments sections. I'm going to do my own. So that's,
I mean, in hindsight, it would have probably been better to like pick one sphere and pick one topic and have a more, you know, disciplined blog, but it was always a hobby for me. I mean, I did it when the kids were napping, like, I was making no money at it. It was just for fun. And so like I wasn't, because it was just for fun, I was, you know, if I wanted to write about, you know, kids, one day I was going to do that. If I was going to talk about something, you know, like a politics or academics, another day I would do that. It was always mostly just for fun, but it really led to other things, which is surprising for me. Like, you know, I've got a 23-year-old now at home, and, you know, I've been talking to him about, like, how, you know, he's starting off. He's like, oh, I got to pick my career, and I'm going to stick with it. Whatever I major in is going to be my career for my life. I'm like, no. You know, it's funny how, like, one thing leads to another. So I had this undisciplined blog that I was just doing for fun, and then people found me. And I met new friends, and it led to other careers and other paths that I could never have imagined. And I mean, my blogging led to me becoming a writer for The Atlantic. You know, I met the right people who got me in the right place, and I learned how to write for a popular audience. And I learned how to, you know, unlearn certain academic writing, you know, styles. And I learned how to become, you know, a writer. and almost like a compulsive writer, like, mm-hmm. you know, like I need to do it. And I do actually have a Substack. I went.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I shouldn't have.
No, I
poorly researched on my part.
I mean, it's again like my blog. You know, I just do it mostly for fun. That one is a little more disciplined. It's more policy and politics oriented. And I mean, I met a lot of people, friends with. People I'm still friends with today. I mean, it was, you know, it was a great experience. It was. And I loved it in its heyday, where there was the back and forth and the real conversation. And things weren't nasty, you know. There was a little nastiness, but you could have a real conversation with people across the political spectrum. And it was so fun that people would all be talking about the same thing at the same time.
There's a line from one of my favorite films called The Limey, Steven Soderbergh's The Limey, and Peter Fonda is talking about the 1960s. And the phrasing he uses to describe it, it's like it was the 60s, but it wasn't really the 60s. It was only 66 and part of 67. But when you were there, you felt at home. Right. You felt like you knew what you were doing. Right. And that's something that's so hard now, because I feel like we were just kind of at Lawyers, Guns, and Money was just kind of at the tail end of it, leading up to the 2004 election. But there was this time where you would write something and Josh Trevino or Jonah Goldberg or even Glenn Reynolds would pick up that theme because they were writing about the same thing. Right. And they were, you know. There was some hostility, right? I think that there was hostility at that time, and people decried the nasty blogosphere. Let me tell you about Twitter. But there was sort of that communal feeling, you know. But that went away. I felt like, you know, that the blogosphere bifurcated in 04, 05, 06, and those kinds of cross-pollinating conversations stopped, right? Even before all the other things happened, those kind of conversations stopped. But I think you were there at really the peak of it in 2003 and 2004.
I mean, it was interesting. There was certain norms that you would go out of the way to see who linked to you and then post an actual link to somebody else who was riffing off of what you were saying. And that way you would be passing the traffic on from one place to another. And it was generous. It was generous, right? Linking and trying to get the audience, you know, passed around. And I mean, it was an interesting time. I mean, I went from like seriously blogging about my kids to getting 1,000 people a day reading some stuff I was reading, and that was, you know, I mean, I was watching Thomas the Tank Engine videos. And talking about, we were getting into debates about this writer like Linda Hirschman. She was writing about feminism and whether you could be a feminist and, you know, what happens if you left academia, if you left a job, were you a bad feminist? There was like lots of conversations about that going on then. Caitlin Flanagan wrote some articles for The Atlantic that stirred up the conversations. There was... You know, I had a foot in both like the academic blogosphere, the political blogosphere, the mommy blogosphere for a while, and the feminist blogosphere. And they were four different worlds.
Right.
And, it was possible to jump in and out, like, you know, a room in a conversation.
Right. And I think that, and I want to shift to specifically the academic here, because it's not well remembered now that the academic blogosphere and the political blogosphere were actually distinct, right? I mean, they were porous, right? Things went back and forth, but you know, there were definitely, you know, sort of bloggers at the time who were very politics focused, and then there were academics who wrote on academic stuff that also had political relevance. And Lawyers, Guns, and Money, much like 11D, I think, was in both of those worlds at the same time, but Here's my question coming out of that, right? Because one of the major topics that was going around the academic blogosphere in this 4, 5, 6 period was this question, and I think you have a unique perspective on it, a perspective that's different than mine and Scott's, right? But there was this question of, am I killing all of my future professional prospects by being this person who is known as a blogger, right? And we all remember Yvon Tribble, right? Did we ever figure out who he was, by the way? Has that ever been, has he or she ever been revealed? I don't know that they have, but
I would love to know, because I that was a real hobby horse of mine. That pissed me off. Yeah. And because the thing is, it's something, and now I'm, you know, because I was actually on a job search last year, you know, and we've done several, and it wasn't, because it was ostensibly about blogging, but it really was, it was unintentionally about how ludicrously arbitrary and capricious, you know, these like searches over these incredibly precious spots that like you have people writing in the Chronicle of Higher Education about how, well, when I saw this guy like Star Trek, obviously we disqualified him from the search. It's like, you're just admitting that, like, really, that's how you're like deciding these jobs, like based on your petty aesthetic biases.
It's like Paul Campos, right? And Paul's recent posts about the deans, right? I can't believe you actually said that.
we're taking this committee to retaliate against you for complaining about discrimination.
I didn't have a problem. Like, so after I taught at Columbia while I was blogging, but I don't think the Columbia people knew I was doing that. And then I taught at a local college in New Jersey. I taught at Ramapo College for 3 years, and I was blogging too. But, you know, I had a full-time job there. But I was not tenure track. And, you know, everybody there was sort of cool about it. I never wrote about like departmental meetings or anything like that. So that was fine. I think, I do think blogging was a problem for Dan Dresner at University of Chicago. And I think that there was other cases. I mean, it's funny though, like, so I ran for a local office last year. I ran for the school board here in New Jersey, and it was a race that was already tied up. You know, there was like a PTA president who was like the sure thing, but I really threw myself into the race, and I learned. And one thing that, you know, I had to be really careful about was what I was writing online, and more so than when I was an academic, because any little thing that you write could be used in these local, you know, against you in local campaigns. You know, there's no more local media anymore. It's all died. And so what's filled its place is Facebook and actually a local blog. Mm-hmm. And they are very partisan, and they don't abide by journalistic norms. Let's just put it that way. So I had to be very careful about what I was writing. So I had to dial it back a lot to innocuous pictures of my kids kind of things.
Now, did you have to, because I gave very brief thought to running for a position here in Kentucky last year. And one of the things that dissuaded me was like, am I going to have to go back and scrub everything? Because I've said a lot of gnarly shit over the last 20 years. Right. And so did you have to do that? Did you have to scrub?
No, I didn't, because nobody has the patience to read through 20 years of my like archives. Like, you'd have to be really crazy to do that. But I did watch what I said, like, you know, everything had to be very carefully posted. I mean, there's people on the internet who are in this local sphere who are just plain crazy. And you have to really watch. I mean, I had one person in the town tell everybody on Facebook that I was handing out flyers outside the high school that was covered with COVID germs. And crazy, crazy stuff. The demise of local journalism is a real tragedy. And weirdly enough, one of the, you know, it's social media and blogging is filling that void, but without any sort of integrity or you know, I mean, it's, some of it's just crazy.
I'm reminded of, and I have thoughts about sort of how to do blog in academia, but I'm also reminded of an incident when John Edwards hired Amanda Marcotte and Lindsay Bearsden. And I don't think we've talked to Lindsay yet, which we really should. And I remember like talking to Lindsay about it, and she's like, you know, I'm happy to get this job, but like, you know, I'm skeptical of a campaign who wants somebody who's like, you can easily find their archives to talk about how they won't favor legalizing heroin, you know, and that's even more so with Lindsay. You kind of had to look for it, you know, with Amanda, because she was so high profile and got a lot of attention, you know, when she had an unfortunate post that got a lot. So pretty much everybody could see how that was going. So, you know, you know, so I think that was a sort of an interesting thing back in the day when the sort of freewheeling nature of the blogosphere, I think some candidates hadn't quite figured out what the implications of that would be. But I feel that's kind of similar to blogging as an academic. And I think what I used to tell people is that if I were like strictly risk averse, I would just say, don't do it. But having said that, I mean, I think, again, you could take precaution, you know, just like, yeah, don't blog about, you know, internal deliberations, kind of treat the, you know, absolute trolling to a minimum. But it's also been an advantage. You know, honestly, I think it's been a net advantage to me. I think without my online writing, not just the blog, but the other writing that the blog gave me, I would guess that I would not have my current position now. You know, that for whatever reason, this UW is a place that likes, you know, its faculty to write, like that the faculty data form has a big thing for non-academic publications, and it's taken into account. So it's partly luck of the draw. You know, you have places like Chicago, and I don't know, if blogging was a factor in Jacob Levy being denied tenure, but my understanding is that it definitely was a problem for Dan. But having said that, they both landed on their feet. I had drinks with Jacob as the chair of the McGill Political Science Department last year. So that, you know, so ultimately it worked out. You find the place that it works for you, right? So I do think that there's that middle ground where, you know, it's like anything else, you know, like any medium can be used in ways that are professionally bad for you. But this kind of blanket thing that you should never say anything controversial in any form. It's sort of like, if you want to be that risk averse, why are you doing this job? It's like there's sort of more remunerative ways to make a living. So I'm two minds about it, but, you know, I guess I'm ultimately, I think all of our choices ended up working on in the end. And Rob, I don't know how you feel that if you think your public profile had anything to do with you being able to secure a good alternative at Patterson, or if it was.
No, I mean, you know, for me, I think that there was just it was a good luck to have a very good fit in an academic position that was very public facing. Right. And so, you know, it has not been without its tears. Right. As you well know. Right. That not everything has been roses. But I'm in a position that I enjoy. And, you know, the public writing that has come out of the blogosphere has been positive for me. And I enjoy doing it. So and so. Coming back to you, Laura, our guest.
Sorry, I didn't mean to divert things there.
No. So I do want to talk just a little bit about some timeline technical stuff. So you started off on Blogger. You know, how did that evolve from there? And also, you know, I'd love to hear a little bit more about the stuff with The Atlantic. And so, like, you know, how did you evolve as a blogger? And then, you know, what kind of doors did it end up opening up for you?
Yeah, it did open a lot of doors. So what happened was, so I started off on Blogger, who wanted to do technical stuff. Then I went to TypePad and then WordPress. And all of my archives are I can find them. They're readily available.
That is rare. I mean, that at this point, that is rare. Most of the people we talk to, so much of it is gone.
Well, yeah. We've been very conscious and we've lost quite a bit.
Well, I actually got screwed over. I wrote a blog post 15 years ago where I had put a picture of Jerry Seinfeld in, which is like a random little thing. But I had pulled it off of Google Images without getting permission. And some law firm found it in my archives. It was 15 years ago. I ended up having to pay the photographer $1,000. For a blog post that had not been seen. You too?
Oh, yeah. We've had, like, I think 4 or 5 times. And we finally just deleted every single image on the site.
Yeah, that's what I spent like a weekend going through. And, you know, some of them I had pictures of my kids. I didn't want to delete. So I actually had to look through it all. Like, what a pain in the ass that was. So I started off a blogger, Typepad. And so I was still in academia from 2003 when I was blogging till that position. I was at the local college. It was a temporary position. I was taking over for somebody who had done an administrative job, was doing an administrative position. Her position ended, so she had to go back into the classroom. So then I had to leave. And it was, I mean, at that point, my husband was still working 12 hours a day in New York City. I had 2 kids, one of whom had autism. I just couldn't like commute somewhere farther away for a job. So I decided permanently I had to leave academia, and I started writing. And the editors there knew me because Megan McArdle had been friends with them, and Megan had asked me to guest blog for her for a while when The Atlantic still had, they were running their own blogs for a while.
Right. So, yeah, they had several pieces. You Glacis was there for a while. Coast was there for a while. Yeah, it was good. They got into that for a little bit before pulling back.
Right.
I'd forgotten that you would guest blog for Megan. Yeah. Who I don't think is going to be part of our series, but anyway.
She's welcome. I would love to talk to Megan. I would love to talk to Megan. And I don't know. We've had people who have declined. So, Laura, we have had people who have declined our invitations because some of the wounds run deep. But, you know, Megan is somebody I would love to have on this program.
And I feel I've not been quite as mean to her as I was to Altos. Like, I'm certainly the reason Altos would do it last week. But anyway.
You know. Megan doesn't take things serious. Like, I think that, you know, she understands debate is what it is, and she would be happy to talk about it. But, you know.
By all accounts, she's a great person. I told this because we did have Mickey Kels on, and I remember, HO's passed up a chance to meet Warren Zevon because Mickey was going to be at the party. And I remember Duncan telling me, is that like, well, it's, you know, it's not even because I think I'll hate Mickey. It's that I'm worried that like, once I meet him, I'm not going to be able to be as mean anymore. Like, that's really the idea. So by all accounts, that is the case with me. I think everybody who knows her gets along with her very well. So it's not a dig. But,
we're just at a wedding together. A friend of ours, a daughter, got married. So I saw her just like 6 months ago. I think it was through Megan. I'm definitely more liberal, but I'm not, you know, a super partisan person. I like to debate issues. I mean, I see myself as a political science professor who likes debate. So I'd always, you know, like to engage in that sort of back and forth. And so we met, I think it was through her and just other people at The Atlantic had been reading my blog. And so I learned how to pitch articles and write for The Atlantic. And so I was writing pretty regularly for them. And then eventually they made me a regular contributor. And I was writing, 2 to 4 articles a month on their education policy website. I mean, that is my background, was education policy. I've got a American specialty, but it was all on education. My dissertation was on the politics of school vouchers. I was teaching at Teachers College Columbia. I was doing research on charter schools and school finance. So I had this background, and then so I started writing for them, and it was really interesting. Like I really had to, I mean, I wasn't a journalist. I was an academic, and I had to learn how to, you know, write a lead and, you know, how do you grab people and, how do you embed links to back up your points and how you do interviews. And I really learned a whole new career from the just generosity of some editors there who taught me how to do it. And it was intoxicating. I could call up anybody in the country and they would talk to me about school stuff. And that was directly because of blogging. And those, you know, I through the blogging, not only did I learn how to write, but I learned about what topics were interesting to people outside of academia. And that was huge. And I mean, I met a lot of people writing for The Atlantic, and I was blogging it too, just in the same time. So I did that. I worked with The Atlantic until they, you know, they had an education section. They ended up, you know, closing it. You know, they had a restructure, and then I still wrote on and off for them and for other education publications. There's the 74 and Edutopia. I did a couple things for Huffington Post. None of this brought me very much money, but it was super fun. And then the pandemic happened, and I just lost my interest in writing things that were not, you know, opinion pieces. I mean, and I was losing patience with editors too. Like, I felt like they were missing some big topics, and I didn't want to be, I wanted to go back to just writing without an editor telling me what to do. So that's why I ended up going, you know, starting a Substack.
The editor thing is really interesting. That's, I know Rob and I both had that experience of working with very good and very bad editors at the American Prospect. In the year of Dobbs, an editor for the New York, the Times Opinion, who I really like, commissioned a piece for me. You know, we talked about it, put it together. I sent it in. You know, she sat on it for 3 weeks and then didn't publish it. And so I don't know what went on there. If somebody else at Opinion had Googled me and found out things I had written about James Bennett, like, I have no idea what happened there. But it is, that editors are very valuable and you lose a lot. But there are also your fellow Jerseyite, the football writer Mike Tenier, who had an amazing piece about having three. You know, he worked for the Messenger, New York Times Sports, and another website that was busted out in the same year. And he did say about his Substack that, you know, you lose things, but just not having, you know, that when he wrote for websites, you know, the first paragraph always had to have the same five words in it, you know, that you were really constricted to those topics. That, like, one thing he likes is now he can just go back to doing his five best quarterbacks of every franchise series, because, you know, you don't have to worry about the traffic of any individual post. It's more important to have a smaller group of people who will pay you $5 a month than it is to sort of, you know, maximize what you're getting on a search engines at a time in which the money you get from being found by search engines is sort of steadily shrinking. So I do think that that's, you know, I think that you, there are definitely writers who suffer a lot from not having editors, but the sort of, I think Substack is reminding us of some of the value of the idiosyncrasy. And I think part of the early blogosphere is that it wasn't just about chasing, that it was expected that people were generalists and they wouldn't just focus on one thing. And I think that's, you know, I think where you fit in really well is that, you know, you did policy stuff, you did personal stuff, and often in different venues, but that you didn't see it as like one, you know. So I think it was a valuable thing, actually. The early blog didn't just specialize on one topic, because I honestly think that was part of what made it interesting. You know, the fact that there's nothing, you could write about politics, you could write about movies, you could write about, you know, that there's no, you know, and again, that limits your appeal to some degree, but I think it's also what makes the writing interesting.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, you know, the editors, to go back to editors, you know, they did sharpen my writing. They did teach me how to take a sentence and go from 20 words to 10 and really make sure everything, you know, really, you know, popped on the page. I had some great editors, and I had other ones, like, I got really frustrated. Like, I did a 3-hour interview with Cory Booker about schools in Newark. And The Atlantic didn't want to publish it. And that just made no sense to me. I ended up publishing it elsewhere, but that was very frustrating. Yeah, there's pros and cons with editors. And I mean, Substack is an opportunity for people. I think that, you know, people like to get their information in their inbox now. Yeah. You know, they don't want to have a bookmark and go to a website. And so I've sort of been using, but there's still a lot of people who, you know, like that blog. So I do both. I keep the blog alive by putting links to what I'm doing elsewhere. But you kind of have to, you know, do both, I think.
Yeah, I mean, where Lawyers, Guns, and Money is concerned, and I think that this is true of a few of the other sort of big legacy blogs, especially Eschaton is sort of leaps out at me, where the people are there for community, right? That it's primarily a space where people who know each other sit and comment about posts, and they don't even have to comment about posts, right? That they know everybody in the community. And so it's like a safer Twitter or a safer Facebook. And, you know, obviously you can only have a limited number of those kinds of sites. But, you know, I think LGM has been fortunate enough to survive on that. In terms of this question I always ask, and so I'm curious about you. If you had to name some major inflection points in the history of the blogosphere, right, where stuff really changed, and especially, I'm curious your thoughts, you know, what really was it that drove the blogosphere into the ground or that at least killed the old blogosphere? You know, we are legacy bloggers hanging out, but the blogosphere as we know it is no longer alive. So what are your thoughts on sort of big things that changed and then, you know, how it all sort of fell apart?
Well, as I think others have mentioned on your series, the getting rid of the RSS feeds on Google certainly was a big contributor to it ending. I mean, and then there's just other places to chat, you know, Facebook and Twitter. And people wanted new shiny things, and so they went elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, that's as succinct as I think we've heard it. So,
yeah, I mean, technology, the new venues opened up and people went with the new venues. And, I mean, being a blogger is also just a ton of work. Right. And I think, you know, it's hard to maintain that level of, you know, work. It's easier to, you know, dash out a few words on Twitter with a link and still get a big following that way.
You get the dopamine hit from the fact that somebody's reading you, and that's all you need with a tweet or a post or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, that
Sorry, Laura.
Just that dopamine hit is huge. I mean, that is a big part of why we do this, right?
And that's one thing, and we found this trying to recruit people. There are very few people who want to do this on an ongoing basis. You know, you can even see that, you know, if you look at, you know, the sort of, you know, the crooked timber we talked about, the kind of, you know, the really big initial, you know, academic blog. And full disclosure, I've been canceled by several of their principals for premature anti-Greenwaldism or something. Dan's actually blocked me on Twitter. No idea why. But if you look at it, it's like, you know, that there's sort of, you know, periods in which, you know, a lot of people write regularly. But for most, if you ever go back to the archives, there's basically like one person writing at any given time. And so many people have effectively given up or mostly given up. You know, there just aren't that many people. You know, there are a lot of people who are enthusiastic and do it for 6 months and then just pretty much give it up to do other stuff or get disappointed because they don't get the traction that they're expecting or whatever. You know, and it is, you know, it's a very, you know, there's only a certain kind of person who can really do that. And it's going to be interesting, too, with like, you know, with Substacks that don't make a lot of money, you know, how many people and I think they're already, you know, there are people who got, you know, the investment when they were signing people up who just didn't pursue it. You know, the people who kind of started Substacks and just ended up not really going through and pausing subscriptions. So that is really, you know, I don't really know, you know, why it is that we've kept up with it. But it is interesting, you know, that You know, how many people who were just, you know, really popular bloggers, you know, just stop, but I can understand that if it's not, you know, it's kind of a hobby, if it's not satisfying to you anymore, you know, then you're just going to quit. And I think that's one reason why it's just not many people can sustain it over the long term.
I mean, I've done it for the community too. I recently lost, a woman who had been commenting for 20 years, just passed away. And I'm like heartbroken about it. I never met her in real life, but we've been having a 20-year conversation. And her sister put a post up on her Facebook page saying she got colon cancer and went in 2 months. And I'm heartbroken by that. You know, it's funny. You know, we really do develop relationships with people with these names in the comments section. And my motivation for blogging changes over time. Sometimes it's for my own mental stimulation. Sometimes I'm blending blogging with Substack now. Sometimes it's because I'm really pissed off about something and I need to vent about it. And for example, the pandemic and the school shutting down was a huge issue just in my family. My kids were destroyed. I had one kid with autism who was a junior in high school, another kid at Rutgers, and the hard school shutdowns we had in New Jersey were really rough on my family.
I know you wrote quite a lot about that, and that was were they able to like sort of keep going online, or what happened? I mean, if anything, I mean, you obviously don't have to share anything that you're not.
Open about it. I mean, yeah. It was bad because I mean the autistic kid, like I mean he's high enough functioning, so he's in a regular public school, but he had no social skills, so his only contact with other human beings happened at school. Mm. So. Here in New Jersey, things really shut down. So it was a full shutdown from like March through September. So he didn't talk to anybody in person for that amount of time. And then school sort of quasi opened up in New Jersey. Actually, nobody showed up. I would send him to school. He would go to school part-time, but nobody would be there, not even the teachers. So he would sit in an empty classroom looking at his laptop. And it just was damaging for him. And then my typical kid, he was at Rutgers. And the first semester was okay because he had already developed relationships with the professors. And so it was...
So he was third year when the pandemic
hit? Yeah, third year at Rutgers.
A lot easier for those. It was a lot harder for first years than third. It was the people who were starting out in online.
It was really hard. Miserable. Well, and it was miserable for him. I mean, he turned 21... And he was at home, like it was so like sad. We did shots with him in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Like not what your 21st birthday should be like.
I do shots with my kids in the kitchen right now, and they're not even 21; they're only 14. So.
it's also interesting the regional because of course Rob, you were only off for the one quarter, right?
Well, yes. So UK as an institution was only out for the spring of 2020. And my program, because we're a very small graduate program, we were back in person in fall of 2020. But most of UK was out for the entire 2020-2021 session.
Yeah, we didn't return until September 21. We were offline. Yeah. Yeah. We're one of the first schools to close, and we not until vaccination was widespread that we reopened. So we were on the other extreme. We were, I think, as severe, even maybe more severe than New Jersey.
The problem for my older guy was that it wasn't just that it went online; it was just everything was on YouTube. So he was watching YouTube. He was watching canned lectures. And, you know, it just didn't work well with his personality. He had to take time off. He's only finishing off now. He really got derailed. And I was just seeing it from other people, too. And so I was trying to write about this. And it was very difficult. It was impossible to get published. Like, I was used to getting published wherever I wanted to. I could not get an opinion piece about the downsides are the downsides to closing schools anywhere. I was trying to write opinion pieces for the New York Times, the Atlantic, where I knew people, Wall Street Journal. I had a list, Washington Post, and I was just sending them op-eds every week, and nobody would publish it. So I put it on my Substack. I mean, that was it was a slush pad for op-eds that I couldn't get published anywhere else. But, you know, and now they're all, everybody's admitting that it wasn't good for kids and learning. But it was hard to have that, you know, said publicly.
I mean, so much of the polarization, the political polarization around that, it feels like it made, Kentucky was weird, right? I mean, Kentucky primary schools, especially in Lexington and Louisville, stayed out for quite a long time. And when they did come back, they were very much what you described, at least at the beginning, was there just weren't a lot of kids there. That a lot of kids just stayed home. And, you know, whatever. I watched the girls where they would be on doing online classes, and there'll be 18 people with black screens trying to talk to the teacher. And so, anyway.
Thing is, it's, you know, I'm not even sure what the right, like, you know, it's like until vaccinations are widespread, I'm not even sure what the right policy was, but we can still admit that the online education is not as good. It might have even been a justified policy response, but, right. You know, it's, let's not pretend that it's as effective, you know. And there's also the issue too, is that, you know, going back to school when people are scared and people are getting sick all the time is not, that's also that you couldn't go back to, you know, January 2020 education, no matter what. So it was a genuinely difficult policy problem. But there was this thing where you just had to say, oh, it's actually just as good, or actually kids don't learn anything in school anyway. You know, it's just like, right, these weird, like, that's where I don't like that.
Aren't kids going to get to benefit from staying home with their moms and dads all day long? I mean, I remember like serious people making that argument. It's like, you gotta be. My kids do not benefit. Neither me nor my kids benefit from being around me a lot.
Yeah. So I was still working as an education journalist in the beginning part of the pandemic. And the editors didn't really want me to write about a pandemic because they thought this was going to be a short-term thing. And they're always want to, you know, have an article that's evergreen that they can, you know, reuse. So I was interviewing teachers across the country and about other topics, but then half the interview would be the teacher saying, oh my God, you can't believe what's going on. So it wasn't just my own experience. I was hearing it from around the country. I remember some teachers up in Oregon who were saying that they're remote, some of these families were like so remote up in the woods that they didn't have Wi-Fi in their own home. So the families had to drive, you know, 40 minutes to the local Target and access the internet from a Target parking lot. Right. And their kids, so they would sit in their car all day while their kids were doing classes in the backseat of a car.
That was definitely a Kentucky thing as well. There was a lot of that in Eastern Kentucky.
I mean, really rough. And so I was frustrated, and that was the reason why it was kind of nice to, you know, I'm blending blogging and Substack, but it's, you know, the idea of self-publishing. Right. For me, it enabled me to get back and talking about things, and my traffic numbers, people were going back to reading blogs again. And I had way more people like coming out and coming back to a blog that was sort of, you know, there, but not quite there, because they wanted to talk to other people about, you know, hoarding toilet paper and, and what their kids were going to do and whether we were all going to die the next day. Did you guys find your traffic numbers were going up during the pandemic?
I paid attention to it, and I did not really notice it. You know, I think that there were definitely spikes, but and you know, it didn't help that Google sort of redid the entire way that they do traffic in like 2022, and it makes it harder to go back and be comparative. But you know, we got the March 2020 spike that everybody got, but then we went back to pretty much our normal numbers after that.
Yeah.
So
wanted to share what kind of grief, and because I still have, you know, a personal aspect to my blog, people wanted to tell their stories.
Right, right. So on that line, and this will be my last question, Scott, you can feel free to ask anything you want, but my last question, one of the reasons I've wanted to do this series is there are so many sort of moments and funny stories and so forth that just got lost as the blogosphere decayed and as archives were lost and so forth. Is there anything in particular that, you know, some story you would like to tell that people just wouldn't believe now, but it happened in the blogosphere, right? It's usually something that dominated the entire blogosphere for like a 3-day period, and nobody was talking about anything else but that, and then completely went away. Is there anything you can think of?
You know, the tempest in the teapot sort of stories.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of them. Like, none actually spring to mind, you know, but I got into a thing with Dan Denbesty. What was his name again?
Denbesty.
Yeah, he went after my friend Tony and I were doing some research for an academic paper about the blogosphere, and he went after us. And the Crooked Timber got involved with it too and were defending us. And so that was a thing. You know, silly in hindsight that, you know, that was going on. You know, I guess, you know, what sticks with me most is the friends that I've made over the years. And that I met through just these online conversations, like-minded people, and like-minded meaning, you know, people who are just like to talk about things and, you know, really like politics and policy and ideas. So that's a big part of what stuck with me with the blogging. And then even just some like random things, like, so I wrote a personal blog post about walking around New York City with my son, who was 2 years old at the time. And he was he had just turned two and he wasn't talking yet. And I was a little worried about it. And then I was talking about how we always have to go walk. We walk when I push him in the stroller around New York, we always had to take the same path. He was felt strongly that we go this way and then that way and that street. And it was just a 3-paragraph thing. And the next day I had 2 readers who wrote me and said, I think he has autism. You should get it checked out. And I was like, at the time I was like, what? Yeah. And it turns out I didn't get an official diagnosis till 3 years later, but yeah, he was diagnosed from autism from readers on my blog. And, you know, that's been one of the themes of my blog too, like inadvertently, is being a mom of a young person with autism and how to handle that. I mean, it had a huge impact on what kind of careers I could take. It had a huge impact on, you know, just trying to get him the right education. And, you know, now I'm helping to steer him to adulthood, and it you know, it still has a huge impact on my life. So it turned out to be, you know, inadvertently, you know, a background theme of what I was writing.
Right.
So
I do want to take away from the first part of your answer that really the blogosphere was the friends you made along the way. Yeah. That was like a sort of a classic.
I still, you know, I met Dan through blogging. I met, you know, we're Facebook friends. I met the two of you guys. We all saw each other at APSA conferences. And I think that was one of the real gifts of the whole experience, was the interesting people I met along the way, for sure.
To show how gracious I am, the bring up Stephen Denbesty caused me to look up one of my favorite posts of all time, Daniel Davies, because, you know, of course, they got famously into Crooked Timber. And one of my favorite blogosphere lines of all time is, remember that living well is the best revenge. The simple corollary of this is that maintaining an anime blog is the opposite of living well, and thus the worst revenge.
What a,
That is a mic drop right there. Anyway. So is there anything, I guess my last question would be, do you see, so obviously, I think that to some degree, I think that a theme throughout the series has been, Substack is a return of blogs, but not a return of the blogosphere. So it definitely shows the appetite for that kind of writing. Do you think that there's the possibility of, nothing like the old blogosphere is coming back, but a little more community, or, is the fact that, most people on Substack sort of have to have paywalls to make a living. Is that going to mean that we're just kind of going to have individual blogs, but that, these aren't really going to foster the same kind of community, whether internal or external, that the old blogosphere had? Or do you think we get at least some of that back?
I think it's just a different medium. And, blogging, came with that blog role at first. And that was a pretty important way of sending traffic to other places on the internet, and spreading and create and identifying yourself as being part of a certain tribe. And Substack just doesn't have that. It's more of a solitary writing experience. There's not the same, I've been doing Substack for a couple of years now, and there's some comments, but it's not like it was in the old days. And people, it's more voyeuristic. People stop, jump in, jump out, see what, if you're talking about a topic that they think is interesting or not. There just isn't that sort of conversation element that we had. Maybe Twitter has even more of a conversation system built in than Substack. Substack is really, it's a solitary thing. You've got your brand, you're talking about it. Everybody I think is hoping for, to make some money off of it. It's not the conversation. I don't know if we'll ever get that back.
Yeah, and Twitter being, overrun by Nazis is not helping the situation either.
Have you gone over to the other, Twitter-esque
platform? I have a Blue Sky, and I do try to cross-post to it, and I am starting to get a little engagement on it, but it definitely is not. It's a network effect thing. It really
right.
is.
Right.
So I do want to keep posting on Blue Sky, because I am hoping that at some point it can be, can replicate that. But it is, there definitely is not the same level of engagement you get on Twitter. There aren't as many people on it. It's not as good.
It's better for some topics than for others, right? For academic themed topics, Blue Sky is actually very good, right? People are engage a lot, because it's a lot of academics. And Threads.
Yeah.
Threads is something different entirely, right? Threads, the algorithm is geared, much like Instagram, the algorithm is geared towards celebrities. And I can be harsh against that, but it's like the decision they've made, right? And I think a lot of celebrities really like it, right? That they like that better than the Twitter experience. So.
But Threads is not a Twitter substitute. I think it's pretty cool. Yeah. Like, he could have done that, but he chose not to. It's going to be Blue Sky or something. And I think Blue Sky is the most promising, because it's just a pure clone of Twitter. Like, right. Where you don't, like, I don't need the, which of the 15, like, Mastodon, I immediately knew was, like, not going anywhere, because just the number of people with the patience for, like, some incredibly technical side of it is not, it'll be interesting to see, but I am at least trying to, and I agree with Rob that the one thing is that, on Blue Sky, you're much likely to get negative interactions. You don't have to mute, Jesse Single can't find me there. So there are advantages, but it's not yet a full replacement for Twitter. In some sense, it'll be like if Elon goes completely off the deep end during this election, that will probably be the, like, now that it's that you don't need an ad code or anything like that, this will be a very interesting tipping point. In terms of that, when Elon writes that $100 million check to Trump or whatever, it's going to be interesting to see if finally we can get Blue Sky to take off. But I think it's at least it hasn't died. Like, it's still growing. I think there's a chance. I'm not super optimistic, but at least it is, it is growing, and there are meaningful conversations. So I'm kind of hoping that it will. I'm hoping that it can function as a viable replacement. I hope that you join up if you haven't.
You have a Lawyers, Guns, and Money TikTok yet?
We do not, but we do have a Lawyers, Guns, and Money Instagram. So, okay. but unfortunately, Elon killed all the automation, so we actually had to hire somebody to do all of her social media posting. So and
by somebody, that's your daughter, right?
Yeah, exactly. She's our social media manager. But Instagram is an extra step after that, right? Because you actually have to take stuff. So it's a lot of work. But TikTok would be great, right? If I could have our social media managers sing and dance out at the title of every post, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I think we would have to involve your daughter. Like, I don't think 50-year-old white guys could do anything with TikTok. Like, maybe if that could be another profit center for your daughters, like if they could drive traffic by figuring out the TikToks, I don't know, but you probably know more lore too with TikToks. I don't have kids, so I'm just TikTok is something I occasionally see on Instagram. Like, I have no idea what is going on, or would have any idea what to do with it. That's not my bailiwick, unfortunately. But maybe that's behind the times. We'll have to broaden our social media presence.
Everybody's there now, so that's they are the biggest competitors. So it's hard to find people who want to read words and think ideas anymore.
Right.
Something that, you know, Rob and I are having to deal with as teachers, you know, and I think that that's an issue that's only going to, it hasn't been a huge problem, at least here at UW, you know, generally, people, you know, students can complete readings about as well as they ever had, you know, but, I'm really concerned, you know, and I'm just hoping that I will be out of teaching by the time this becomes a real, pedagogy is going to just have to be completely upturned, because you just can't, you know, and it's not about intelligence. It's about, kids who grow up, it's hard to sustain that, you know, what's necessary to read words. So it's going to be very interesting as both writers and educators, in ways are going to be really, not necessarily bad or worse, but definitely challenging.
Right, right. There was a good article, I think, in Slate recently, just about how students don't have the patience to read long articles anymore in their classes.
Is that Adam Kotsko, I think, speaking of old blogosphere guys?
Not sure who wrote that.
I forget.
Yeah,
I don't remember.
It might have been.
Yeah. It was good. Anyway, it was. I liked it. Yeah, so excellent. Well, I see that it's already dark on the East Coast. So, Laura, thank you so much for your time. It was a really fantastic conversation. We're really happy to bring this series back. And best of luck to you and your family. Hopefully there will be no lockdowns in the immediate future. No more, the DeSantisism hopefully will not fully hit New Jersey. We'll not have too many quarantines. And best of luck to everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. And please check out both Laura's blog and or Substack. And going back to the apartment, I like that, harkening back to the New York roots, even if you're still the full-on apartment D, 11D. But hopefully most of you have read Laura, but if you haven't, you will learn a lot. I always enjoy your writing, and hopefully we can do this again.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Good seeing you. Take care.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying as our intro and outro music I'd Bet My Lands and Titles, a track on the album For Executive Meeting. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate at the PayPal link on the website. Thank you.